After having spent some time with his guru to receive his instruction, a zealous disciple was returning to his hermitage. While walking, he began to meditate and, according to a well-known reverential custom, he imagined his worshipful teacher was seated on his head. After a time, he entered a state of trance in which he felt perfectly sure that he was carrying his lama. A stone or some other obstacle caused the man to fall, but so strong was his concentration of thought that the shock did not break it. He got up loudly apologizing, "I beg your pardon, precious one. I am so sorry to have let you fall, I hope you have not hurt yourself. Where are you, now?" And the good disciple hurried away to examine a ravine nearby in case his lama had rolled into it. Another story about the lama on the head was told me by a Dagpa Lama. The joke is coarser than the former one and reflects the mind of the sturdy massive Dagpa Hillman. Annan, it is said, was advised by her spiritual teacher to imagine him seated on her head when meditating. She did so accordingly and was so successful that the weight of the venerable lama, who was a well-fed, tall and stout man, gave her great pain. Women of all countries, we must believe, are peculiarly clever at finding a way out of their troubles. When paying another visit to her guru, he asked if she had carried out his instruction and imagined that he was seated on her head. "I did, precious one," answered the nun, "and indeed, your weight became so painful, that I changed places with you and sat on your head myself." One variety of exercises in concentration consists in choosing some kind of a landscape, a garden for instance, as a subject of meditation. First, the student examines the garden, observing every detail. The flowers, their different species, the way in which they are grouped, the trees, their respective height, the shape of their branches, their different leaves and so on, noting all particulars that he can detect. When he has formed a subjective image of the garden, that is to say when he sees it as distinctly when shutting his eyes as when looking at it, the disciple begins to eliminate one by one the various details which together constitute the garden. Gradually, the flowers lose their colors and their forms, they crumble into tiny pieces which fall to dust and finally vanish. The trees, also, lose their leaves, the branches shorten, and seem to be withdrawn into the trunk. The latter grows thin, becomes a mere line, more and more flimsy till it ceases to be visible. Now, the bare ground alone remains and from it the novice must subtract the stones and the earth. The ground in its turn vanishes. It is said that by the means of such exercises one succeeds in expelling from the mind all idea of form and matter and thus gradually reaches the various states of consciousness such as that of the pure, boundless space, and that of the boundless consciousness. Finally one attains to the sphere of void, and then to the sphere where neither consciousness nor unconsciousness is present. 219. That is to say that it is an indescribable state to which the ordinary notions of consciousness and unconsciousness cannot be applied. 219. These four contemplative meditations are often mentioned in early Buddhist scriptures and are recognized by all sects as part of the spiritual training. They are called formless contemplations. Many methods have been devised which lead to these peculiar states of mind. Sometimes the later states are produced by a contemplation absolutely devoid of cogitations, while in other cases they follow a series of minute introspections or are the result of prolonged investigations and reflections regarding the external world. Lastly, it is said that there are people who suddenly reach one or another of these four states of mind without any preparation, in any place or during any kind of occupation. The following exercise has already been briefly described in the story of the man who felt himself to be a yak. However, it includes developments that were unknown to the hero of that story. For instance, the disciple has chosen a tree as an object of meditation, and has identified himself with it. That is to say that he has lost the consciousness of his own personality and experiences the peculiar sensations that one may ascribe to a tree. He feels himself to be composed of a stiff trunk with branches. He perceives the sensation of the wind moving the leaves. He notes the activity of the roots feeding under the ground, the ascension of the sap which spreads all over the tree, and so on. Then, having mentally become a tree 220, which has now become the subject, he must look at the man, who has now become the object. Some lamas have told me that the aim of these practices can hardly be explained, because those who have not felt their effects could not understand the explanations. 220 seated in front of him and must examine this man in detail. This done, the disciple again places his consciousness in the man and contemplates the tree as before. Then, transferring his consciousness once more into the tree, he contemplates the man. This alternative transposition of subject and object is effected a number of times. This exercise is often practiced indoors with a statue of a stick called Gomsheng meditation wood. Properly speaking, the Gomsheng is merely a stick at which one gazes to obtain fixity of mind. The burning incense stick is a variety of Gomsheng. A burning incense stick is also used in an obscure or completely darkened room to dispose the mind to meditation. But I must again lay stress upon the fact that it is not intended to produce an hypnotic state. Preparation for meditation is called Nyampajagpa. It consists in bringing the mind into perfect stillness, and the contemplation of the tiny dot of fire at the top of the stick helps in producing that state of calm. People who habitually practice methodical contemplation often experience, when sitting down for their appointed time of meditation, the sensation of putting down a load or taking off a heavy garment and entering a silent, delightfully calm region. It is the impression of deliverance and serenity which Tibetan mystics call Nyampajagpa, to make equal, to level, meaning calming down all causes of agitation that roll their waves through the mind. Another exercise which, however, seems to be seldom practiced, consists in displacing one's consciousness in one's own body. It is explained as follows. We feel our consciousness in our heart. Our arms seem to us to be annexes to our body, and our feet seem to be a distant part of our person. In fact, arms, feet and other parts of the body are looked at as if they were objects for a subject dwelling elsewhere. Now the student will endeavor to make the consciousness leave its habitual abode and transfer it, for instance, to his hand. Then he must feel himself to have the shape of five fingers and a palm, situated at the extremity of a long attachment, which joins onto a big moving structure, the body. That is to say, he must experience the sensation that we might have if, instead of having the eyes and the brain in the head, we had them in the hand, and then the hand was able to examine the head and the body, reversing the normal process, which is to look downwards in order to see the hands or the body. What can be the aim of such strange exercises? The most frequent answer given to my questions will probably seem unsatisfactory by many inquirers, yet it is probably quite correct. One attains, by the means of these strange drills, psychic states entirely different from those habitual to us. They cause us to pass beyond the fictitious limits which we assign to the self, the result being that we grow to realize that the self is compound, impermanent, and that the self, as self, does not exist. One of these lamas seized upon a remark I had made as an argument in support of his theory. When he spoke of the heart as the seat of thought and mind, I had said that Westerners would rather place thoughts and mind in the brain. You see, immediately replied my interlocutor, that one may feel and recognize the mind in different places. Since these filings experience the sensation of thinking in their head, and I experience it in my heart, one may believe that it is quite possible to feel it in the foot. But all these are only deceitful sensations, with no shadow of reality. The mind is neither in the heart nor in the head, nor somewhere outside of the body, apart, separated, alien to it. It is to help one realize this fact that these apparently strange practices have been devised. Here again we meet with the clearing process. All these exercises aim at destroying habitual notions accepted by routine and without personal investigation. The object is to make one understand that other ideas can be put in their place. It is hoped that the disciple will conclude that there cannot be any absolute truth in ideas derived from sensations which can be discarded while others, even contradictory to them, take their place. Kindred theories are professed by the followers of the Chinese T.S.224.kun called Zen sect, in Japan. They express them in enigmatical sentences such as, "Lo, a cloud of dust is rising from the ocean and the roaring of the waves is heard over the land. I walk on foot, and yet on the back of an ox I am riding. When I pass over the bridge, lo, the water floweth not, but the bridge floweth. Empty-handed I go, and behold, the spade's handle is in my hand." And so on. The doctrine of the Zen sect has been defined by one of its followers as the art of perceiving the polar star in the austral hemisphere. This paradoxical saying resembles that of the Lama who said to me, "One must discover the white in the black and the black in the white." I shall cite a question, current in Tibet, which mystic hermits, as wed as philosophers living in monasteries, put to their pupils. "A flag moves. What is that which moves? - is it the flag or the wind?" The answer is that neither the flag nor the wind moves. It is the mind that moves. The followers of the Zen sect ascribe the origin of this question to the sixth patriarch of their sect. Once, in the courtyard of the monastery, he saw two monks looking at a flag floating in the air. One of them declared, "It is the flag that moves." The other affirmed, "It is the wind that moves." Then the master explained to them that the perception of emotion which they experienced was not really due to the wind or to the flag, but to something existing in themselves. We are in doubt as to whether such ways of thinking have been imported into Tibet from India or from China. I may, however, state the opinion expressed by a Lama, the Bonpos. He said, taught such things long before Padmasambhava came to Tibet. Abandoning further investigations on the transcendental results of transferring one's mind to different parts of one's body, I may remark that during this exercise, a peculiar sensation of heat is felt at the spot where one has transported his consciousness. It is rather difficult to ascertain whether the phenomena consists in a real increase in heat or a subjective sensation only. The very idea of undertaking such investigation would break the concentration of mind and so destroy the cause that produced heat. As to making observation upon other people, it is almost impossible. Tibetan hermits and their disciples have nothing in common with Western professional mediums who work for money and allow us to examine the phenomena which they produce. The most insignificant pupil of a Gomjin would feel astonished if such a proposal was made to him. I can hear him answer, "I do not care whether you believe or not in these phenomena, and I have no desire to convince you. I am not a juggler giving theatrical performances. The fact is that Orientals, excepting vulgar charlatans, do not make a show of their mystic, philosophic or psychic knowledge. It is most difficult to win their confidence in these matters. A traveler in search of information may be the guest of a Lama for several months, drink tea daily with him and go away thinking his host is an ignoramus, while on the contrary, the Lama could have answered all his questions and told him more things than he has even thought of." Whether the heat be actual or subjective, the exercise has more than once warmed my feet, and given me a refreshing sleep while spending the night under a tent or even without any tent, outdoors in the snow. But unless one has been trained for a long time in the practice, it requires strenuous efforts which make it extremely tiring. To conclude, I will call attention to the fact that the terms which I have translated by consciousness and mind have not exactly the same signification in Tibetan as in English. Tibetans distinguish as many as 11 kinds of consciousness and have 3 words in their language which we are compelled to translate by mind, though each of them bears a special philosophic meaning. A frequent way of ascertaining the degree of the concentration of mind is to place a small burning lamp on the head of the novice who is to remain in solitary meditation. Tibetan lamps consist of a cup-like receptacle, made of metal or mud. The base of the lamp enlarges at the bottom, which is shaped like a second cup turned upside down. These lamps are filled with melted butter. A wick is thrust into a small cavity bored for that purpose at the bottom of the cup. When the butter cools, it forms a cake and the lamp is ready to be lighted. This apparatus easily rests on the crown of the head as long as one preserves absolute immobility, but it falls off at the slightest movement. Now as perfect concentration produces complete immobility, any failure is proved by the fall of the lamp. It is said that a lama who had once placed a lamp on the head of a pupil found him the next day still seated in meditation, but with the lamp beside him on the ground without any butter in it. Answering his master's question, the novice who had not understood the aim of the exercise replied, "The lamp did not fall down, I myself took it away when the butter was exhausted and it went out." "How could you know that the lamp went out, or even that you had a lamp on your head, if you had reached true concentration of mind?" retorted the teacher. "Sometimes a small bowl filled with water is used instead of a lamp. Certain masters also command their disciples either before the time of their meditation or immediately after it, to carry from one spot to another a bowl with water up to the brim. This exercise aims at testing the degree of tranquility of the mind. The slightest agitation of the mind, whatever may be its cause, joy or sadness, memory, desire, etc., is likely to produce a movement of the body. Now, the least quivering of the fingers is sufficient to shake the bowl and the quantity of water poured out, as well as the number of times the accident happens, discloses the more or less violent movement of the mind. Such at least is the theory on which the exercise is based. This theory and the exercises which have been devised from it, are known all over the East. Indians tell pretty stories about them. Here is one. A rishi had a disciple whom he believed already far advanced in spiritual development. Wishing that he might receive supplementary teaching from Janaka, the kingly sage of great repute, he sent the young man to him. At first Janaka left the newcomer for several days outside his palace gate without allowing him even to enter the courtyard. Nevertheless, the well-trained disciple, though he was of noble descent, did not show the least sign of being grieved, offended, or displeased by this humiliating treatment. When he was finally admitted to the presence of the king, he was given at the door of the throne hall a bowl filled with water up to the brim and ordered to walk with it in his hand all round the hall. Janaka, though his mind was utterly indifferent to all worldly things, was surrounded by true oriental splendor. Gold and precious stones glittered on the walls of the great hall, the courtiers wearing costly jewels surrounded their sovereign, and the palace dancing girls, as beautiful as goddesses and scantily clad, smiled at the young stranger passed before them. Nevertheless, the disciple went through the prescribed ordeal without spilling a drop of water. Nothing offered to his eyes had been capable of producing the slightest movement in his mind. Janaka sent him back to his guru, saying that he did not need any lessons. Tibetans are acquainted with the theory regarding the colors, which is classic among the followers of Hindu tantrism. Most likely it has been imported into Tibet from India or Nepal, but the interpretation given by the lamas differs on a number of points from that which is current in Hindu circles. The colors are said to be centers of energy that are situated in various parts of the body. They are often called lotus. The practices connected with the colors belong to the esoteric teaching. The general aim of the training in which the colors play a part is to direct a stream of energy to the higher lotus, the Datong, lotus with 1,000 petals, which is situated at the top of the head. The different kinds of exercises in this training aim at utilizing the energy naturally expressed in animal manifestations connected with sex, for the development of intelligent and supernormal powers. The lamas belonging to the Dzogchen sect are practically the only masters of this teaching. Again, certain disciples are advised to contemplate the sky and sometimes to confine themselves to this practice only. Some lie flat on their back in the open, in order to look at the sky with no other object in sight. This contemplation, and the ideas which it excites, is said to lead to a peculiar trance in which the notion of personality is forgotten, and an indescribable union with the universe is experienced. All lamas agree regarding the usefulness of most of these strangely artful training practices. Yet, when reading certain treatises about them or listening to oral explanations given by some mystic masters, one not unfrequently detects a restrained impatience. The teacher who instructs us seems to say, "Yes, all that is necessary, perhaps, even indispensable to the majority of novices, but as a preparatory drill only, The goal is elsewhere. Let us make haste and finish with the preliminary process. The following sober method keeps closer to this goal, at any rate its working is more easily understood. The master orders his disciple to shut himself in tsums and to meditate, taking his yidam as object of his contemplation. The novice dwelling in strict seclusion, concentrates his thoughts on the yidam, imagining him in the shape and form ascribed to him in books and images. Repeating certain mystic formulas and constructing a kayakara are parts of the exercise of which the aim is to cause the yidam to appear to his worshipper. At least, such is the aim that the master points out to the beginner. The pupil breaks his contemplation during the time strictly necessary to eat and the very short time allowed for sleep. Often the recluse does not lie down and only dozes in one of those gomti which have been described in a previous chapter. Months and even years may elapse in that way. Occasionally the master inquires about the progress of his pupil. At last a day comes when the novice informs him that he has reaped the fruits of his exertion, the yidam has appeared. As a rule, the vision has been nebulous and lasted only a little while. The master declares that it is an encouraging success, but not as yet a definitive result. It is desirable that the recluse should longer enjoy the hallowed company of his protector. The apprentice Naljorpa cannot but agree, and continues his effort. A long time again elapses. Then, the yidam is fixed, if I may use the term. He dwells in the tsumskang and the recluse sees him as always present in the middle of the kayaka. This is most excellent, answers the master when he is informed of the fact, but you must seek a still greater favor. You must pursue your meditation until you are able to touch with your head the feet of the yidam, until he blesses you and speaks to you. Though the previous stages have taken long to be effected, they may be considered the easiest part of the process. The following are much more arduous to attain, and only a small minority of novices meet with success. These successful disciples see the yidam taking on life. They distinctly feel the touch of his feet when, prostrated, they lay their head on them. They feel the weight of his hands when he blesses them. They see his eyes moving, his lips parting, he speaks. And lo! He steps out of the kayaka and walks in the tsumskang. It is a perilous moment. When wrathful demigods or demons have been called up in that way, they must never be allowed to escape from the kayaka, whose magic walls hold them prisoners. Set free out of due time, they would revenge themselves on the person who has compelled them to enter this prison-like consecrated circle. However, the yidam, though his appearance may be dreadful and his power is to be feared, is not dangerous because the recluse has won his favor. Consequently, he may move about as he pleases in the hermitage. Even better, he may cross its threshold and stand in the open. Following his teacher's advice, the novice must find out if the deity is willing to accompany him when he walks out. This task is harder than all previous ones. Visible and tangible in the obscure hermitage fragrant with incense, where the psychic influences born from a prolonged concentration of thought are working, will the yidam's form be able to subsist in quite different surroundings under the bright sunlight, exposed to influences which, instead of supporting it, will act as dissolving agents? A new illumination takes place amongst the disciples. Most yidam refuse to follow their devotee into the open. They remain obstinately in some dark corner and sometimes grow angry and avenge themselves for the disrespectful experiments to which they have been submitted. Strange accidents occur to some anchorites, but others succeed in their undertaking and wherever they go enjoy the presence of their worshipful protector. You have reached the desired goal, says the guru to his exultant disciple. I have nothing more to teach you. You have won the favors of a protector mightier than I. Certain disciples thank the Lama and, proud of their achievement, return to their monastery or establish themselves in a hermitage and spend the remainder of their life playing with their phantom. On the contrary, others trembling in mental agony prostrate themselves at their guru's feet and confess some awful sin. Doubts have arisen in their mind which, in spite of strenuous efforts, they have not been able to overcome. Before the yidam himself, even when he spoke to them or when they touched him, the thought has arisen in them that they contemplated a mere phantasmagoria which they had themselves created. The master appears afflicted by this confession. The unbeliever must return to his Samskang and begin training all over again in order to conquer his incredulity, so ungrateful to the Yidam who has favored him. Once undermined, faith seldom regains a firm footing. If the great respect which Orientals feel for their religious teacher did not restrain them, these incredulous disciples would probably yield to the temptation of giving up the religious life, their long training having ended in materialism. But nearly all of them hold on to it, for if they doubt the reality of their Yidam, they never doubt their master's wisdom. After a time the disciple repeats the same confession. It is even more positive than the first time. There is no longer any question of doubt. He is thoroughly convinced that the Yidam is produced by his mind and has no other existence than that which he has lent him. That is exactly what it is necessary for you to realize. The master tells him, gods, demons, the whole universe, are but a mirage which exists in the mind, springs from it, and sinks into it, a declaration continually repeated by Tibetan mystics. Chapter 8, Psychic Phenomena in Tibet, How Tibetans Explain Them. In the preceding chapter one have already mentioned some incidents that may be classified as psychic phenomena. It may be useful to take up the subject again, for the fame which Tibet enjoys in foreign countries is largely due to the belief that prodigies happen there as plentifully as wild flowers grow in the fields. Whatever certain people may think about the matter, strange events are far from being usual in Tibet, and it is good to bear in mind that the observations which I have condensed into a few pages are the result of researches which lasted more than 10 years. The fascination exercised by Tibet as an abode of sages and magicians dates from a time long back. Even before the Buddha, Indians turned with devout awe to the Himalayas, and many were the extraordinary stories about the mysterious, cloud-enshrouded northern country extending beyond their mighty snowy peaks. The Chinese also seem to have been impressed by the strangeness of Tibetan wilds. Amongst others, the legend of her great mystic philosopher Lhotse relates that, at the end of his long career, the master riding an ox started for the mysterious land, crossed its border, and never returned. The same thing is sometimes told about Bodhidharma and some of his Chinese disciples, followers of the Buddhist sect of meditation, San sect. Even nowadays one may often meet Indian pilgrims on the paths that climb towards the passes through which one enters Tibet, dragging themselves along as in a dream, hypnotized, it seems, by an overpowering vision. When asked the motive of their journey, most of them can only answer that they wish to die on Tibetan ground. And too often the cold climate, the high altitude, fatigue and starvation help them to realize their wish. How can we explain this magnetic power in Tibet? There is no doubt that the reputation enjoyed by the land of snow for being a country of wizards and magicians, a ground on which miracles daily occur, is the main cause of its attraction over the majority of its worshippers. But now one may ask for what reason Tibet has been credited with being the chosen land of occult lore and supernormal phenomena. Perhaps the most obvious cause is that already mentioned, the extreme remoteness of the country, enclosed between formidable mountain ranges and immense deserts. Men compelled to abandon cherished ideals incompatible with their stern, prosaic surroundings, are eager to transplant them to a more favorable fairyland. As a last resource, they build gardens in the heaven and superterrestrial paradises to shelter their daydreams. But how much more readily will they seize upon the opportunity of lodging them in an earthly country? Tibet offers that opportunity. It has all the physical features of a true wonderland. I do not think it is exaggerated to say that its landscapes surpass, in all respects, those imagined by the fanciful architects of gods and demons' worlds. No description can convey the least idea of the solemn majesty, the serene beauty, the awe-inspiring wildness, the entrancing charm of the finest Tibetan scenes. Often, when tramping across these solitary heights, one feels like an intruder. Unconsciously one slackens pace, lowers one's voice, and words of apology for one's unwarranted boldness come to the lips, ready to be uttered at the first sight of a legitimate superhuman master on whose ground one has trespassed. common Tibetan villagers and herdsmen, though born amidst such surroundings, are strongly influenced by them.